You're listening to a DM podcast.
Welcome to The Five of My Life with me, Nigel Marsh. As an author, ad man and theologian, I've always been interested in people's stories. Not just those with a high profile, but people from all walks of life, regardless of fame. Which is why I created this show. Each guest who takes the Five of My Life challenge chooses a favourite film, book, song, place and possession. They tell me their choices in advance so I can research them, but they don't tell me why they've chosen them. That's the subject of our conversation. It's amazing what you can learn when discussing someone's five choices. I hope you enjoy listening to the show as much as I enjoy making it. Doug Taylor is the CEO of the Smith Family, Australia's largest children's education charity. A lovely man with a fascinating, moving and inspiring backstory. It was a real pleasure hearing him tell his stories and recount his lessons. So Doug, welcome to Five of My Life.
Thank you, Nigel.
Now, you are here because of the wonderful Five of My Life community. I ask every guest to nominate someone that they want to hear. But there's a second stream where listeners write in quite regularly and say, oi, you should interview, I don't know, Tom Cruise or Oprah Winfrey or whoever else. And someone called Stu wrote in and said, you should interview Doug Taylor. So Just before we get into the actual choices themselves, would you mind talking to that relationship?
Yes, yeah, would love to. So Stu's a good friend who I've got to know. As a mammal, I say with a little bit of embarrassment, a middle-aged male in Lycra.
Mammal,
that's right. So, you know, we hit that stage of life. And so I've gone from other forms of sport to running. Now I'm on a bike because it's all I can manage. But in the course of that, you meet great people riding in groups. So Stu lives not far from me and we ride in the Southern Highlands of New South Wales, spend many hours out together riding, and you get to know people pretty well, actually. He's a terrific person.
Okay. Right, well, so let's hope we don't disappoint him.
That's right, no pressure.
And no pressure at all.
No pressure.
Now, we start with the film on Five of My Life, always. And you have chosen the film adaptation of Harper Lee's 1960 classic, To Kill a Mockingbird.
That's right. Perhaps a little predictable given my line of work and the like. But, really kind of little interesting little backstory. So I remember sitting in the mid-80s in one afternoon, Pennon Hills High School, I think it was Year 9 English. I was not in one of the top English classes. It was a lower English class, not particularly great at school. And we had one of the really good teachers from one of the top classes. And we were studying To Kill a Mockingbird. And she played the film. And I still remember it being played in the classroom and just being struck by a couple of things. One, you know, the Atticus Finch character. I mean, you know, dashing, persuasive lawyer, all those things. Kind of, you know, probably a bit seduced by the, you know, heroic male individual, all that sort of thing at that age, and a bit of white saviorism and the like. But still, it stirred something in me in terms of somebody trying to make a difference, stand up for something. And it had quite a profound impact on me. And from that kind of time forward, it was clear to me that whatever I do, I try to be making a difference in big and small ways. And that's kind of been my working and volunteering life for a long time. And, you know, one of the ways that has kind of become really important to do that for me has been really thinking about the fact that in the human lottery of life, we are born into the families that we're born into through, you know, just by those circumstances. And sometimes that's great, sometimes that's less great. And, you know, a lot of my work is about trying to ensure that we do as much as we can as a society to give young people every opportunity they can, because there's so much innate potential in all the young people. One of the great joys of my role at Smith Family is I meet a lot of the young people that we support. And there's just extraordinary talent. And with the right opportunities, they do incredible things. And we kind of have this myth, I think, in society that, you know, life is like a race. We all start at the race line together. And the ones that succeed are the ones that work the hardest, have the innate natural gifts. In reality, a lot of kids start 50 metres behind. They've got backpacks that are weighing them down. Unless we provide extra support to them, they just don't have a chance. And so that's a lot of the work that I've done over the course of my working life and at the Smith Family. And look, honestly, Nigel, I don't have a problem getting out of bed in the morning and go. It's just a wonderful gift to be able to do this work. It's a real privilege, and I enjoy it enormously.
For some of the listeners who aren't familiar with the Smith family, can you give the elevator pitch description of of the wonderful work that, that they and you do?
Let me tell you the founding story very, very quickly. It's a crazy story. So five businessmen 101 years ago in Western New South Wales, having done some business out in the country, having a pub in Parramatta one night just before Christmas. They're talking about what they're going to do that Christmas with their families. The conversation turns to what is it like for a disadvantaged child at Christmas? Long story short, they pulled together some gifts, went to a local orphanage, gave those gifts. The matron asked, who should I thank? One of them said, thank Mr. Smith, because they wanted to be anonymous in their giving.
So it wasn't brilliant.
No, it wasn't actually Mr. Smith.
Right.
It was about being anonymous. It was kind of, it's kind of a quaint notion if you think about the social media age, being anonymous in doing something. But that was a, there was a sense of duty and obligation, I think, at that time. And so they all called themselves the Smiths, those five people, hence the Smith family. And so we had our centenary last year, and I'm a bit of a history nerd, and we got into the archives and our early years. And for the first few years when they were recording minutes, they'd all call themselves Mr. Smith. It was mostly men at the time. So it's actually impossible to find out who the founders are because of that sense of anonymity in giving. From that, an organisation that's done a lot of welfare relief over time. About 30 years ago, after talking to other families that we'd supported, asking them, how can we best support you? They talked about really the need to support their child's education. So from then, we've been increasingly focused on addressing educational inequality. We support, through one of our flagship programs, Learning for Life, about 60,000 students across the country, all who experience disadvantage, by providing financial support, working with their parents and carers, principally to support them to best support their child's education. All the data shows that the biggest predictor of education success is actually parental engagement in a child's education. Schools, teachers are great. I wouldn't want to undermine their value. They're incredibly important, but the more parents are engaged, the better the outcomes. And running a range of programs in about 700 disadvantaged schools. So that's the shape, if you like, of this.
And how do you qualify for I've got four kids that left home now, but just pretend, you know, 20 years ago I go, I want some help. Do you go, sure, or do you go, prove that you need it, or how does that mechanism work?
Yeah, great question. So effectively we rely on our school partners, all disadvantaged schools, to identify the students and families who could benefit most from those programs. So it's a scope of a sense of what their need is that has to be validated, but also the degree to which they're willing to work with us and partner together, because we need people invested in the work that we're doing together. So it's those two things.
And this isn't supposed to be a curly question. This is I'm genuinely fascinated by this. Is, and then how do you measure outcomes, not outputs? In my time, I've done a bit of work with a variety of charities.
And I can hear that.
And some people are quite keen to talk about the outputs, which are great. And then you get to the outcomes and, I don't know, literacy hasn't actually been improved. So you go, well, forget the leaflets, mate. It's not working. Anyway, so how do you guys do it?
Oh, thanks for asking that question. I'm so glad you have. It's a bit of a passion of mine as well. We can nerd out later on measuring outcomes. That's a whole thing. And look, you're dead right. It's really important that we take that seriously. And, you know, we're raising, you know, lots of money, people investing in our work. So we want to be treating that money like an investment in us and our work. So we measure it rigorously by looking at the degree to which our students we're supporting are attending school, their achievement, how well they're going with achievement data, their completion of school, and their post-school engagement. What are they doing after school? Are they going to further education or employment? So, in fact, I was just at a meeting this morning, we were looking at that data. And I've got to say, at the moment, it's really tough. Cost of living pressures, COVID, attendance is possibly the worst it's ever been. And that attendance, school attendance, was going south pre-COVID. So there's something bigger going on in society and in the minds of, you know, parents and students as to how they think about education. So there's some big heavy lifting to for us as a nation in terms of how we might turn that around. And we're in the middle of conversations with government and the like about the future of education. And, you know, school attendance is one of the big things we've got to be focusing in on and addressing.
And what is your workforce? Is it largely volunteer, part-time, full-time? How do you engage with the people you're helping?
So about 1,000 staff, about 5,000 volunteers. We started by volunteers. Volunteers are incredibly important for us. So I just recently volunteered for the Smith family,
right.
Changed hats and jumped into one of our volunteer programs. I mean, it's a fascinating little program. Basically, mentoring a young person in one of our partner schools, a young guy, talking about education and careers and the like, 12 weeks, all done by chat, 1 hour a week. Now, for a dinosaur like me, who's great at doing thumbs up and okays, chatting with a young person like that, it's how they engage with their peers and others. So great way for them, not confronting, but a real challenge for me. But terrific in terms of the opportunities. And we had some great conversations, getting to know each other and then talking about, you know, he wants to become a painter and thinking about also becoming a chef. And so I'm researching how to do that whilst I'm talking to him. And, you know, so those kind of mentoring programs now going online is a whole new way to look at different types of volunteering, because one of the things that really concerns me is that volunteering in Australia is at record lows. So I think from 2019 to 22, 2 million people stopped volunteering in Australia. Mm. So a big drop in our participation rate. And that just means that organisations like the Smith Family, we've just got to find new ways of helping people explore opportunities to volunteer in their community. I mean, I've volunteered all my working life as well, and it's one of the great joys of life. So I see the great value of it, and we want more people to have that opportunity and make a difference at the same time.
Tell us the most heartwarming story of a family or child that you've helped.
There are so many, honestly. The one that comes to mind is a young man I met early this year, James. James is a really impressive young guy in his 30s now. So one of the benefits of the Smith family is supporting a lot of people. We do that for the course of their education experience, but they become adults. And you have these conversations reflecting back on their experience as a child. It's incredibly reflective about the challenges they experience. So anyway, James sadly lost his father when he was a young boy. He died, I think it was in a fishing accident. That led to his mother really having some big mental health challenges, also grappling with substance abuse. And for a time as a young boy, he was effectively her primary carer. So you can imagine what he's dealing with in going through that, the impact on his education. We got to know James with some other organisations and help him, providing that financial support. Our workers were connecting and engaging with James, and he had opportunities to do careers-related programs at school as well. Discovered in him a passion for sport. Somehow, through our networks, got him an opportunity to go and shadow the physiotherapist at the Australian Institute of Sport, you know, for work experience, and that turned the lights on for him. And so set off a passion, become a physio. We supported him through university. You know, it's very expensive, obviously, university and housing and books and the like. So James is now in his 30s. He's a physiotherapist working his own practice. He's just had his first child. And he told me recently about an experience he had when he was at the local hospital as physio doing a shift. And he said, I had one of those sliding door moments where a young man came in to accident emergency, and he said, that could have been my life. Clearly, a young guy has had all sorts of challenges, and it was just one of those contrasts you see that with the right support at the right time by the right person, you know, it just says to me that people who face challenges can go on and do great things and be great contributors in society. It's about getting those things to people when they need them.
It just must be amazingly motivating
to see
that. And then they hopefully become your advocates out in society.
Oh, absolutely.
And so James presumably will speak very highly of the Smith family.
Yeah, no, they're great ambassadors. You know, we have a lot of money to raise for our work, and honestly, all I need to do is bring along a student and they tell their story, and they're very generous in telling their stories and really reflective of the challenges. And just one other quick anecdote, Shane Hyde, CEO of Simply Energy now, gone on and done great things. He recently reflected at a forum about the experience of shame and stigma as a young boy growing up experiencing poverty, and how that meant that he felt uncomfortable about asking for help. He didn't want to appear to be different to his peers. I think we can all relate to that. And that impacted his education because he couldn't afford the books that he needed for his classes at the time, but he didn't want to put his hand up and say that. So, you know, and we obviously were able to support him, and he's, again, gone on and done terrific things. And, you know, it's not about successing the incredible things. But for me, it's about just celebrating progress, the small steps that people make, given the enormous baggage and challenges that they carry with them from an early life.
I love hearing these stories, and it's a wonderful sort of quirk that for the format you started in down this track because of a film that you saw.
Yes.
I mean, so it's called The Five of My Life because it's supposed to be five things that lead to, and you go, wow, well, that was straight out the gate, your film changed your life. We're going to move to your second choice and got a bone to pick with you.
Oh, I'm keen to hear it.
Well, when you came in, you said, blimey, you bought it, and did you read it? Of course I did. I'm going to drop it on the table now. It's the biggest hardback business book. And business books are a genre that, how can I say this in Winnie the Pooh language, that normally I wouldn't wipe my backside with, but in your honour, I read The Practice of Adaptive Leadership by, it sounds like a bunch of New York accountants, Heifer, Grasso and Linsky.
Yes.
I'm keen to hear, maybe explain what the book is first for our listeners, because I doubt many of them have read this.
No, sure. And I'm keen to hear your view on it too, as to what you thought. So this book came at a really important time to me, or the kind of the thinking, adaptive leadership came to me. So I did a leadership program in 2004 called Sydney Leadership. This was the framework that was being used at the time. And look, I'm not going to go into the detail and dissect the framework. I think what has stuck with me from this kind of way of thinking is that leadership is an exercise and not a role. In other words, we can all lead if we want to think about how we can influence others to create positive and lasting change. Now, that was a big shift in my thinking at the time. Maybe it was a slow learner or something, because I'd equated leadership with roles, as I think a lot of people still do. And also equated leadership with the people who have the X factor, or people who seem to have all the answers, you know, that kind of mythology of leaders. And the more you work with so-called leaders, the more you realize it's total BS.
Yeah.
We're all making it up as we go. And at that time, when I was doing that program and kind of thinking about leadership and reading some of that material, I started working with a guy called Steve Lawrence. Steve is the late Steve Lawrence, wonderful guy, a real mentor for me. Steve started up an organization called Work Ventures in the late 70s. In short, a group of Christian hippies. So kind of living the alternative lifestyle, applying the kind of Christian principles of the kind of early church, you know, pulling their resources together in order to make a difference. And they were living together in La Perouse. So they started doing some incredible things in La Perouse, and over time built this organization that started to do more in economic development, a whole range of things. And I joined that team in the early 2000s and was working with Steve. And he just gave me opportunities to have a go. He was a serial entrepreneur and a really difficult person to work with, broke all the molds of what we think leaders were, but so purpose-focused, so, you know, laser-like focused on what he was trying to achieve. And he let me have a go at doing things. So, you know, with him, we were setting up technology centres and public housing estates because we were worried about people being left behind in terms of technology access. We started a PC recycling venture that still runs today, taking decommissioned corporate PCs, refurbishing them and distributing to low-income families. It's now connected up 80,000 people across the country. And actually, the Smith family is working with that organisation now to help our young people get connected as well. And so, you know, it just had a profound impact on me in terms of really just, I guess, empowering me to think about, well, yeah, I can do this. I can have a go as well at being a leader and trying to influence others in the kind of broader sense of what that really means.
So there's something in the space that you're in that fascinates me. It's analogous in a way to the creative space, where it's one thing to be creative, it's another thing to be able to commercialize it. It's one thing to have good intentions, which I think most of us do. Yeah. It's another thing that the angels of this world like yourself who actually have good intentions and want to do something about it. But then to have an organization that is functional and sustainable, not in an environmental sense, I mean, as in is going to last, is you need all the stuff that's in this book. Because running an organization that goes bust or all the employees are miserable, or I mean, there is no hiding place from the harsh realities of the actual world.
Absolutely.
You're a serious business person. The fact that your business is helping families in need is lovely, but you've still got, I mean, you report sort of to the ex-CEO of Macquarie.
Yes, Nicholas, that's right.
Who probably isn't a complete pushover. And you need to raise lots of money and you've probably got, I don't know, have you got 1,000 volunteers probably any one week, 20 of them are bent out of shape because something hasn't happened. But would you mind talking about the business challenges?
Thank you. It's a great question, and it is a real challenge. So, you know, actually, Steve had this line he stole from someone else, I'm sure, which was, you know, there's no mission without a margin.
Wow.
No mission without a margin, because we were running, just starting all these social businesses, and margin is really important to kind of invest in what you're trying to do and create great working places and environments. So, look, I agree. And I was just talking to a group of business leaders, it was just last week, and, you know, I was kind of saying to them, you know, what you're doing is great. Running businesses provides shareholder returns. You're providing goods and services for the community. It's really important. Excellent. Good. However, it's much harder to do that and change the world at the same time, which is what we do in not-for-profits. We have to run good, sustainable organisations, retains people, builds our reserves so we invest in the future, and we're also trying to improve the lives of people and change the society. That means working with government and other organisations. And, you know, for us at the Smith family, yes, we're doing it and supporting those 60,000 students through Learning for Life, but we're also trying to work with government to change the future of education, because we know there's actually 1.2 million children experiencing income poverty in Australia today, and we're working with a small number of those young people, still a large cohort, of course. But the bigger change is actually to change policy to ensure that schools are getting great outcomes for young people in our community now and into the future because of those big challenges. You know, just to illustrate that for you, Nigel. So if a young person by the age of about 15 who might experience disadvantage in their life, on average, if you look at the NAPLAN data and what Grattan research will show, they can be 4 to 5 years behind their peers in literacy and numeracy. That is a big gap by the age of 15 to try and catch up. So clearly, we've got to be doing something different with our education system. We've had a great education system in the past that served generations well. Teachers and schools are really doing hard work in difficult circumstances, but we've got to do something different going forward to get different outcomes for young people. And I was just at a forum last night with a group of colleagues and we're saying, why aren't we angry about this as a nation? Why aren't we actually mobilised around the fact that so many of our young people are falling behind and we're not adequately investing? So that's the sort of work of a not-for-profit, trying to run an organisation and change the world at the same time. It's tough, but, you know, it's exhilarating.
Now, and I imagine those five wonderful people who weren't called Smith but were called Smith, if they were here in this room now, 101 years later, and I asked them the question, would you be pleased if the Smith family didn't have to exist? Yeah. They would say, absolutely.
Yeah. Yep. It's a good insight. I had a lot of my team together last week from our national office in Sydney, and I said something, and I've said this at a few events with supporters, saying, particularly around our centenary, I would not lose any sleep if the Smith family wasn't here in 100 years, if we'd done our job. And what matters is that not that we sustain our organisation, but that we sustain the impact and the difference that we're making. And if that means that ultimately we go to business, that'd be great.
That's
Wouldn't we
fantastic.
Celebrate that?
Yeah.
But that's the important thing, because it's very easy, as you know, in an organisation, you get caught up with the institution and keeping the wheels running, not kind of asking those bigger questions around what difference are we actually making?
It would be fantastic if the Smith family didn't exist. I mean, it's going to be a few years, but you go, because the point is to, you know, so vulnerable families, you know, haven't got educational challenges.
Yep.
Wonderful. One quote from the book.
Yeah.
I'm being harsh on it. I mean, I don't like the category because I think it's sort of rehashing, you know, flashes of the bleeding obvious. But, but it was actually quite interesting about the balcony view, and diagnosis, then action. But one of the phrases that I've written in my copious notes here is adaptive leadership, which was the title of the book, always involves helping people deal with loss. Would you mind talking to that?
Oh, it's fantastic, isn't it? Any good change requires tough decisions and trade-offs. And invariably, there are winners and there are losers. And so a lot of the thinking in adaptive leadership is, how do you bring people along in order to achieve that change? Because, you know, the losses might be around, there could be resources, or it could be just ways of thinking that people have been previously invested in. So a lot of what they talk about there is pacing the change. How do you have the right conversation. So you're turning up the heat and kind of going, you know, full frontal into those difficult conversations. We're not doing it, making it too hot, too hard, so you blow people up, but bringing people along. So I think that's the essence, I think, of the challenge on big kind of social challenges, but also in organisations as well, where you've got to leave things behind in order to do new things. You know, one of the things I'm really proud of at the Smith family is that I had that 100 years, but that 100 years of constantly doing new things and changing. And one of the things that we've been leaning into a lot is digital inclusion. You know, we want all of our young people to have a connected laptop. It seems bleedingly obvious, but 15% of the families that we're working with don't, and probably about 15% of the students don't have a laptop. Now, you think about the educational impact for them. It's enormous. That's a big new thing. Right? So what do we need to leave behind to take on this big new thing? What have we got to do differently? So it's those sorts of things, I think, that are really the art of leadership in helping people work through those things together.
He had a great analogy in the book of vegetable soup.
Ah, yeah.
I really liked it. It speaks to what your point that you've just made, where about not too hot, not too cold. You go, if you nuclear blast it and keep it on the stove for an hour, it's just mush. Yeah. If you don't heat it enough, then the potatoes and the carrots haven't. You know, you need to get it just right.
It's a good analogy, and I think the other thing that's inherent in that is that he talks about is that our human nature always drives us to comfort over discomfort. So invariably the role of leaders is really about turning up the heat in a productive way at the right time, so we lean into those right things, because ultimately we'll avoid that at all costs because we don't like pain as human beings. So I think that's again one of those kind of challenges.
Now, your third choice is the title track from the 9th album of the Indigo Girls, All That We Let In.
We've lost friends and loved ones much too young, with so much promise and work left undone, when all that guards us is a single center line, and the brutal crossing over when it's time.
In 2004, my wife Kath and I were due to have our second child, so eldest daughter Jemima, and unfortunately, tragically, Hugh died 7 hours after being born, so really terrible experience. He had pulmonary hypertension, which means that his lungs didn't make the transition from being in the womb to breathing independently, so that was just a horrific, horrific experience. And in fact, it would have been Hugh's 19th birthday on Sunday, just gone. So we were together at his grave, reflecting on you know, our loss and what that means. So, you know, these experiences shape you in ways you don't fully understand. And it was had a profound impact on Kath and I, particularly on Kath, who obviously carried Hugh all that time. So I think what that meant for me was, that song we played at Hugh's funeral, I think for me it had this kind of impact in just, it's obvious, but profound for me, was around the preciousness of life and how important the time that we have is in our lives, and reflected on that a lot. And I think through losing Hugh, I've just become, I hope I haven't gone over the top, but just really real intentional about time and how I use it. You know, I want to use time for things that matter, but also for things that support people that matter to me at the same time. So become quite disciplined around that. And, you know, I think about that stoic philosophy of, you know, that memento mori. In other words, you know, they talked about every night the practice of thinking that you might not wake up. So what do you need to do tomorrow? What do you need to do differently? And so that kind of has been really, I guess, ingrained in me, the discipline of how we use time and focusing on the right things, and equally with that being just really purposeful about life and all those things. So that I guess is one of the big impacts of my life in losing Hugh in that way.
That is such a sad story, mate. And if you don't mind me asking, did you know during the pregnancy that it was trouble? Oh,
no,
my
complete,
word. Oh, my
complete,
word.
Complete shock. So...
So you went from joy to seven. Oh, mate, you're making me well up.
It was awful. In a matter of moments, very quickly it became aware that something was wrong. And, you know, I can still, you know, nurses and doctors were, you know, wonderful. They were so good to us and helping us kind of process that in the moment and afterwards. It was just awful. And I still remember... You know, at the kind of the final, the last few hours we had Hugh, I had, while the nurses were looking after Kath, I held him and I took him outside and just was kind of outside sitting with him and the breeze kind of blowing, just blowing his hair around the like. And it was just, you know, you just those kind of moments that sit with you. So, yeah, really, really kind of awful, really awful experience.
Such a credit that you've managed to... to take something positive out of it in terms of being intentional rather than, I can imagine, disappearing down the bottom of a glass or, you've had kids since?
Yeah, so, our daughter Bridie is just finishing her HSC this year, actually. So we had another child, which was wonderful. So, family's really important, obviously. When you lose a child, those relationships matter enormously to you. And so we're really grateful to have our girls, particularly in losing Hugh. But he's with us and we certainly remember him.
One of the lines in the song basically is about life happens and we need every part of it to shape us. And it's I can imagine if I had your story, I'd want to punch someone who said that. But it's it is sort of true. I mean, it is... It's like you're saying about we don't choose where we're born. Mm. You know, we could have been born in, you know, war-torn Syria or somewhere. Yeah. Mate, that's just such a sad story.
And it's, look, I've obviously had lots of friends and family who've been through, as we all have, all these enormous challenges. And it's a real fine line between looking for too much meaning in suffering and those awful things, but also being reflective and responsive and acknowledging that it does shape you and kind of thinking that through. So it's try to get that balance and not be too fatalistic, kind of maintain that sense of optimism and hope. And that often people who go through those crushing experiences is very hard to do that. And, you know, and just credit to Kath. Kath's a remarkable person in terms of, you know, she's had significant health challenges as well, but remains... this incredibly, and with losing Hugh too, still remains this enormously optimistic and hopeful and positive person, and invariably shaped in part by that.
Your fourth choice is where we are sitting.
It is.
Woolloomooloo.
It is.
Tell us your story about Woolloomooloo.
Woolloomooloo, yeah, what an amazing place. An incredible kind of history and a pretty vibrant community. And for those who don't know, Woolloomooloo is a suburb between the CBD of Sydney and King's Cross. You know, quite a gentrified place, but also public housing estate. There's a community of rough sleepers. Matthew Talbot Hostels, just over the road from where we are, who supports lots of homeless people, does great work. So Woolloomooloo, back in the mid-90s, was where I had my first role coming out of college. So first role was working with rough sleepers in the community, people who experience, you know, drug and alcohol addictions up around the Cross as an outreach worker. And for someone just coming out of college, it was enormously kind of confronting. It was at the time when it was a heroin epidemic at that period. So confronting in that was working with people who were rough sleepers, but also really difficult addictions with heroin. There were literally people dying in the sleep. I can still remember names and images of people that we lost in that time. So it's significant at that point because I was seriously thinking, is this the work I want to do? Is this what it's like? Because it's so difficult and quite despairing, and asking the question, can you actually make a difference? Can you create change? So I moved away from that work and was doing other work for a while. But over the course of my working life, I've been coming back to Woolloomooloo in different incarnations, doing different things. And each time it's been stories of hope, which has been kind of wonderful to have that circle of life, if you like. So the next time I came back to Woolloomooloo, very different circumstance. I was in philanthropy, working with a Swiss bank. And we came down with one of those big oversized checks to give to the community of Woolloomooloo, terribly cheesy things. Try not to do big oversized checks if we can, but still, it was great to be doing that. However, We had this community event. The funds were being handed over. A lot of people from the community came together. And I looked around and I realised that a lot of people there were people that I'd worked with 10 years prior, and they were still homeless on the streets. And I was thinking, all these organisations doing all this great work, yet people are still on the streets. How, you know, how can that be despite all our efforts? And so anyway, we, with a group of people, including one of the Swiss bankers, came together and said, what would it look like if we found 90 homes for 90 lives? At that point, we knew there were 90 rough sleepers in Woolloomooloo. The upshot of that was, with business leaders and government leaders and community leaders, we found those 90 homes, and funding from the government to get people off the streets into secure housing with wraparound supports and exactly what they need. And surprise, surprise, even with people with mental health issues and all sorts of challenges and addictions, get them a house, get them support, they become citizens, people who are just, you know, living an average life and getting on with things. So it was a wonderful kind of experience. And from there, a lot of programs have ensued that really focused on what's called housing first, getting people off the streets and getting the supports that they need. So that was kind of one time I came back to Woolloomooloo, which was wonderful. The other one was, I mentioned the heroin epidemic at the time. In another role, I came back and had was responsibility for looking after medically supervised injecting centre in King's Cross. That's a program that started in the early 2000s. Premier Bob Carr ran a drug summit, basically creating a space for people to safely inject, under the premise that problematic drug addiction is a health problem. It's not a problem to be criminalised. And we want to keep people alive in order to provide them with supports, because if they're injecting in unsafe ways or by themselves and using drugs in those ways, then that creates enormous risk to them. And that program, remarkably now, has been running for over 20 years. It's now being run in other parts of the world and down in Melbourne. And in King's Cross, there's been 10,000 overdoses in that centre and not one death.
Right.
For me, I find that enormously hopeful. I think of all the lives saved by a great program that's focusing on the health issues and not punitive measures and criminalising a problem. So Woolloomooloo has been a place of great experiences for me. Difficult at the same time in terms of what you see, in terms of the challenges that people experience. The problems aren't all solved in Woolloomooloo, of course. But, you know, I just, again, I've said it before, but with the right programs, the right supports at the right time with the right people, can do great things for people when they need it.
If I flipped the coin, you've talked a wonderful story about James and the wonderful 90-bed story. Would you mind talking to an initiative or a project you were involved in that, with the benefit of hindsight, 10 years later or whatever, you go, well-intentioned, but oh my God, what the hell were we thinking? It had bugger all effect, or indeed it made things worse.
Probably one of the programs that comes to mind is, you know, when I was at Workventures, and this was mixed, I'd say this was mixed kind of success. Again, we were focused on trying to bridge the digital divide, and we were really concerned about remote Indigenous communities. Lots of challenges for those communities. Great strengths as well, great cultural strengths, wonderful deep history, and, you know, lots of great cultural leadership as well. But what we were trying to do was create effectively internet cafes in those communities, because we were worried about the young people falling behind with their learning and being isolated and removed. So we created a few white elephants, if that's the right description, may not be the right metaphor, because we really just didn't do the work of engaging the community. But also, we didn't address the tyranny of distance, because, what do you know, computers break down. And there weren't the skills in those communities to repair the hardware, and we didn't have the kind of the pipeline of support and supply of replacements and the like. So that's one of the big kind of learnings, and, you know, over time we looked at doing that differently. And so shifted from kind of the classic go in and put the hardware in place, you know, if you build it, they will come sort of philosophy, to focusing on building leadership and building capability, and particularly providing those supports so that the leaders themselves could do that work, and that we were just enabling them and providing the resources that they needed, and particularly around some of the technical training and the like. So again, not rocket science, but a shift in approach, I think, was the big lesson. And sad thing is, I still, you know, people still make those same mistakes, I think. You know, going in and all guns, have we got a solution for you, community? Mm-hmm. Instead, listening and particularly listening to leaders and supporting them with what they need and helping them take the leadership role for their own community.
That's just wonderfully honest and instructive and helpful, you telling that story. It shouldn't stop people being well-intentioned.
No.
Because you make a mistake doesn't mean you should stop working in the field. I remember ages ago, 90s, working in anti-drugs, and we did a set of posters to try and stop people doing heroin. And the model that we used, we made look horrible and wasted and whatever, was stuck up on posters. The phrase heroin chic, Kate Moss and all that stuff, is the poster, the image that we used to put young people off from doing heroin was attracting them.
Goodness me.
Yeah. It just mind-meltingly, how on earth could you want to look like that? She's clearly skeletal and blah, blah, blah. But you've just got to look at outcomes.
Yeah.
So everyone involved in that, no one wanted to do that, to have that outcome. No. But rather than be defensive about it, that was idiotically non-effective. So rip it up and learn.
And it's right, good intentions aren't enough, I think is the point, isn't it? I mean, they're great, but it's a combination of focusing on outcomes, thinking about unintended consequences. I mean, I think that's one of the great lessons is, think about the downsides, what could go wrong and what you need to do about it. But again, fundamentally, it's just about listening. I think we're getting better at doing that and taking seriously people's voices and empowering them to guide and direct us. There's a big focus with a lot of peer organisations that I work with about prioritising lived experience. So people that have those experiences, how do we listen to them? How do they have roles of leadership? So, in a couple of weeks, this might be a bit of a spoiler, but we've got our annual general meeting at the Smith family and we'll be inviting onto our board one of our former students.
Wonderful.
Now, so he will bring to the table all his experiences of experiencing poverty as a young man, the challenges with his education, all that insight will be front and center in the decisions that we make. And a lot of organizations are thinking about that. And I think that's a great thing to have those insights. I think it says something about what you prioritize and what matters when you think in those ways.
Wonderful. Your fifth and last choice on Five My Life is your first birth certificate. How many have you got, mate?
That's right. Many false identities. No, I have two. So backstory is my birth mother, Kay, conceived me in Perth, Western Australia, and came over to Sydney to have me at Crown Street Women's Hospital and put me up for adoption. So Kay, at the time, as she tells me, had things were a bit challenging in the family at the time. Brother had just come back from the Vietnam War. Things were disrupted. And it was a different era. So without telling the family, flew all the way across, had me, told the family at some point later. And then I was born 3 weeks later. I then met my adoptive parents, Richard and Louise. So two birth certificates. Second one, Douglas David Taylor. First one, Michael James Lidlow. So these kind of two, almost against the sliding doors things.
Yeah.
Two kind of identities, if you like. And I remember, in my late 20s, embarking on that journey of understanding where I came from, in a sense, from all those years ago. I left it to the late 20s. I wanted to be kind of fairly settled as a person. It's, adoptive experiences can be pretty challenging for a lot of people. It's not a common practice these days as it was back in the 70s, because I think we prioritise blood connection and connection to family. And it's very difficult, I think, for those who have to make very difficult choices in child protection. I don't envy their roles, and they're trading off the connection with sometimes risk of harm and abuse. Very, very difficult choices. That wasn't my situation at all. But so that's my kind of backstory as to how life has unfolded to me. So I feel, honestly, Nigel, it's been a good experience for me. I feel like I've got two wonderful families. My adoptive family are really important to me. They've shaped me and influenced me in really significant ways, and reconnected with Kay and my birth father, Ross. And there's a whole, in fact, in a few weeks, I'm going over for my sister's wedding in Perth with Marita and Seamus. And so it's been a really positive experience for me.
When did you get back in touch with Kay?
Yeah, late 20s, so to complete that story. So it's a really interesting process. At the time, docs at the time in New South Wales, very cautious about how to make those connections, because you can imagine, quite confronting, and particularly for the birth parents to have somebody out of the blue. So they have what's called a reunion register. So where either party puts their name down in advance to say, I'd be open to meeting the other person. And if there's a match made, they'll then connect you up and provide the your details. So we corresponded first with Kay. We were writing for a while. Similarly with Ross, we were writing. Then a few phone calls. And then a little later, we said, why don't we come over? So still remember going over with Kath. We hadn't had any of our girls at the time, or Hugh, and flew over and... meeting her for the first time. Actually remember she got the times wrong, and so it was a total surprise us being there. We were supposed to be coming a day later, which was probably good for her to not be so anxious. So, yeah, it's been a really positive experience. And I think I'm sure psychologists will have there's a lot of theory around the impact on children who are adopted. And for me, I think it's one just – underscored how important family is. So, you know, Kath's the most significant relationship in my life, wonderful person. Daughters are incredibly important to me. They're probably the greatest mentors for me in my life. It's very special. Any time that they're together is wonderfully rich and valuable for me. I think the other thing too, what I've taken from that is the importance of, I don't know how to describe it, but open families. So blood connections are important, but they're not everything. It's important to have kind of open families that welcome other people as well. And, you know, we've tried to do that in our family. And just a kind of an example of that, Kath, probably about 10, 12 years ago, when there was a number of people coming from Sri Lanka as refugees, connected up with a Sri Lankan man, Kumar, and his daughter, Vinny, out here by themselves. And so we were trying to think about how can we support them in getting this, you know, what they need to be connected into the community. And we started building relationships and supporting them. Anyway, long story short, tragically, Kumar took his life. Isolated, you can imagine, by himself with his daughter, struggling to kind of work out how things operate in Australia, unemployed. We tried to make connections for him, but you know, did his best, but it was just a really difficult time for him. So Vinny was by herself, so our family and a few others kind of connected with her and got her what she needed, connecting with school, place to live, helped her then move on to further studies and do other things. And you know, she's just had her first child with her partner, which is exciting. Trained preschool teacher, gone on to study aged care, and just got permanent residency 2 days ago, which was, you know, so, so wonderful. So, yeah, wonderful to have those kind of stories, again, of hope. But I guess what I take from that is, you know, obviously in my professional life, we can do a lot in providing service and support, but often it's what communities can do. Families just connecting with families, people connecting with friends by organising groups to ride together. You know, just communities looking after each other is as important as all that we do in government in providing services as well.
I've just adored this conversation. I've been writing furiously whilst you have been speaking, and there are so many lessons, from the one you've just said about the importance of family to being aware of unintended consequences. I love the 90 bed story. If I Google that, will that come up?
You will.
I encourage everyone else to do the same thing. That was just, I love initiatives that actually work. The story, so moving, but you being intentional about time, because I mean, how can you not be, having gone through that experience? I love the "there's no mission without a margin." I wish I'd heard that earlier, because that really neatly sums up lots of the issues I have with certain institutions where I think you are fantastic, but you ain't going to be here in 2 years' time, blah, blah, blah. And I suppose my overall takeout, I mean, apart from it, you're a lovely rooster and it's been gorgeous meeting you, mate, it is the message of hope that you can change, just like your film set you on a certain path at the age of 9 or whatever, you can change a life forever. Yeah. That the most awful circumstance, there could be somebody on the streets, you know, a smack addict, whatever, the right intervention at the right time can change that life, that can then knock on effect, change 120 lives because mate, more power to your elbow.
Thank you. Thanks, Nigel.
You're a bloody legend. But you have one more choice.
Okay.
Which is the sixth choice on Five My Life. Who would you like to hear take the challenge next and why?
Great. Thank you. So, well, as I mentioned before, I'm on the board of Wayside Chapel and love their work. You know, their kind of mission of there being no us and them, seeing the importance of communities coming together as one, people in all their great, wonderful diversity and richness. So I would suggest that you get John Owen, the pastor and CEO of Wayside Chapel. John has an incredible story. You know, worked internationally, worked out in Mount Druitt, Western Sydney for a number of years. Much of his work today is, you know, working on the streets of King's Cross. Every week he sends out an email called The Inner Circle, which just tells stories of his conversations that he's having with people. He doesn't romanticise poverty or the life challenges, but just takes the insights, and it just pumps your tyres up every week when you read his email. So I think do yourself a favour and get John Owen.
Well, that's your challenge, mate. Because okay. I will be emailing you this afternoon saying, can you introduce
Absolutely,
me?
Absolutely, of course.
Doug, thank you so thank much you. For sharing your choices on Five of My Life.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode. If you follow Five of My Life, you might enjoy my latest book, Smart, Stupid and 60. In it, I write about a number of the issues discussed on the show. It's the 20-year follow-on from my first book, Fat, Faulty and Fired. If you have any feedback on the book or suggestions for the show, please get in touch via my website, nigelmarsh.com.